From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the course of a year, the investment house Drexel Burnham Lambert went from funding the leveraged buyout of RJR Nabisco, the largest corporate takeover in Wall Street history, to bankruptcy. Is this the end of an era on Wall Street? We ask Wall Street Journal reporter Brian Burrow, co-author of Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of RJR Nabisco. Also, cinematographer Ernest Dickerson tells us about his long collaboration with filmmaker Spike Lee. Dickerson shot all of Spike Lee's features and student films. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Uncommon Genius, a collection of interviews with winners of the MacArthur Awards. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. The newly legal African National Congress announced today it will soon send a delegation to South Africa for direct talks with President F.W. de Klerk. In a statement issued at the end of a three-day conference in Lusaka, Zambia, the ANC said it plans to reestablish its anti-apartheid movement in South Africa to prepare for the return of exiles after 30 years. In Lebanon's Christian enclave, troops loyal to General Michel Aoun say they've captured a key militia position in East Beirut after a second day of fierce fighting. Nearly 600 people have died in 17 days of intra-Christian warfare, Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia.
Aoun's claiming a major victory. If so, it's been a costly one. He's lost many troops and has been unable to crush pockets of die-hard militiamen. This was only one militia stronghold in the capital. There are several more. The impact on the civilian population has been devastating. One hospital threatened to close down after it was shelled, and an orphanage was also hit. Radio stations broadcast appeals from people telephoning from burning buildings. Send help, they pleaded, but sniper fire and water shortages meant firemen could do little. Aoun went on radio to declare that the militia stronghold had been liberated, but one witness likened the area to a cemetery hit by an earthquake. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Israeli warplanes have staged another raid into southern Lebanon. The army says an Amal guerrilla base 30 miles south of Beirut was the target of the nighttime attack. There were no reported casualties. In Romania, protesting military officers have won their demand for the resignation of the defense minister, criticized for his association with the old guard of the Ceausescu era. From Bucharest, Kathleen Hunt has the story.
General Nicolae Militaru followed 5 days of demonstrations by military officers and their civilian supporters. They're increasingly critical of the strong communist background of the government of President Ion Iliescu. The choice for his replacement, the economic minister Anastasi Stanculescu, has pleased the protesting officers. But the departure of the defense minister meets only one of the military's demands. They still insist on the resignation of the interior minister and a purge of all members of the armed forces who supported the Ceausescu regime. These include thousands of the widely feared Securitate forces who've been incorporated into the army since the December uprising. When the resignation was announced, demonstrators outside the television headquarters shouted, "Down with Iliescu, down with communism, and down with Securitate." For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
Radio Moscow says rioting in Soviet Central Asia spread today to the Uzbekistan Republic. The violence between local Muslim majority and ethnic Armenians follows a week of unrest in neighboring Tajikistan. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials fell almost 14 points to close at 2635.59. This is NPR News. Former President Ronald Reagan kept a court-ordered appointment at the federal courthouse in Los Angeles today. In a session closed to the public and the press, the former president gave videotaped testimony to be used in the Iran-Contra criminal trial of his former national security advisor, John Poindexter. Defense lawyers had 154 questions plus follow-ups for Reagan, focusing on his meetings with Poindexter. The former president also faced cross-examination by Iran-Contra prosecutors. U.S. District Judge Harold Green has ruled that an edited version of Reagan's testimony will be released at some point. Teachers in Utah are voting on whether to stage a statewide walkout next week. A strike would be the second for Utah this school year. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Utah teachers walked out of their classrooms last fall after lawmakers failed to address a crisis in education. Teachers here are among the lowest paid educators in the nation. They teach in some of the most crowded classrooms, and they complain about shortages of books and supplies. Today, they're deciding whether to walk out again. Utah's governor and legislature have offered $10 million for new textbooks and a 6% increase in pay and benefits. They pleaded with teachers today not to strike and offered a new package that could reduce class sizes and raise teacher pay by as much as 10%. The new package and today's strike vote will be considered tomorrow by teachers' union officials. They'll decide whether a strike will be called. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
A Los Angeles Superior Court judge today sentenced musician Ike Turner to 4 years imprisonment on cocaine charges. The 58-year-old Turner was convicted on two drug possession charges last month. Before being sentenced today, he pleaded guilty to one count of carrying cocaine and another possession charge stemming from a separate case. Ike Turner could be released on probation after 20 months. In the 1960s, his Ike and Tina Turner Review produced a string of hit records. Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last Tuesday, Drexel Burnham Lambert became the largest investment firm ever to file for bankruptcy. It was just a little over a year ago that the company financed the largest corporate takeover in history, the takeover of RJR Nabisco by Henry Kravis, the king of the leveraged buyout. My guest Brian Burrow covered the RJR Nabisco story with John Hellyer for The Wall Street Journal. They've collaborated on a new book called Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of RJR Nabisco. RJR Nabisco is a conglomerate that manufactures such foods and cigarettes as Oreos, Ritz crackers, Lifesavers, Winston's, and Salem's. The takeover of RJR Nabisco was financed by junk bonds, and during the past decade, Drexel Burnham Lambert pioneered the use of junk bonds to finance leveraged buyouts. I asked Brian Burrow if the failure of Drexel Burnham Lambert signals the end of an era on Wall Street.
It is very definitely the end of an era. Drexel Burnham's use of junk bonds not only transformed the leveraged buyout industry, it transformed Wall Street, and it made possible the incredible restructuring we've seen of corporate America in the last 10 years. And with its demise, an awful lot of people think that restructuring is going to slow down significantly.
When you say restructuring, what are you referring to?
The restructuring, I just referred to all the takeovers and the leverage buyouts that have seen so many venerable names disappear and others evolve into other things.
Now, why did Drexel Burnham collapse?
Well, Drexel Burnham collapsed. The simple reason is because of the government's investigation to allegations of all types of securities laws violations at the firm over the last few years.
And the more complicated reason?
Well, the more complicated reason is with all sorts of politics and the fact that Drexel was not doing a lot of things that some of the powers that be held were responsible. At least that's what Drexel's backers would tell you. But in the end, what happened was simply that the government's investigation combined with some of the woes in the junk bond market just made it untenable for the firm to continue as it had.
Drexel Burnham's bankruptcy is the largest bankruptcy in Wall Street history. Let's talk about some of the repercussions on Wall Street. Who do they owe money to that are going to be affected by this?
Well, they owe money to an array of foreign and domestic institutions, and it remains to be seen whether or not in its eventual liquidation those firms will receive all their money back. I think what we should be looking at even more is the array of Drexel finance deals, including that of the largest takeover in U.S. history, RJR Nabisco, whose eventual successes will depend on Wall Street's ability to sell those junk bonds. Drexel was the one firm that everyone felt could sell junk bonds in any type of climate, even one that we have that's as bad right now for junk bonds. And so the big question has got to be whether or not replacement firms such as Merrill Lynch will be able to keep some of these deals afloat in Drexel's absence.
And if the deals aren't kept afloat in Drexel's absence, what happens to a company like RJR Nabisco that was backed by Drexel Burnham?
Well, in a worst case basis, what would happen to RJR Nabisco is exactly what's happened to Compo Corp and its crown jewel Bloomingdale's, which are now in Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Now, you know, the New York Times pointed out something that I thought was kind of funny in its own way, that a lot of lawyers were going to lose money because of Drexel Burnham's bankruptcy, because the lawyers relied on Drexel Burnham's business from merger activity and also from criminal problems. Drexel Burnham is where Boesky and Michael Milken and Dennis Levine had worked.
Well, that is certainly right. Obviously, while some of the criminal attorneys may lose some money, I dare say some of the bankruptcy attorneys will reap it.
How did the leverage buyouts help Drexel Burnham before it helped to kill them?
Well, leverage buyouts and takeovers in general, the frenzied pace of these were made possible by Drexel's innovations in the junk bond field in the early 80s. Taking just LBOs, for instance, leverage buyouts, prior to Drexel Burnham's innovations, the way you financed an LBO was it often took months to get the money from an insurance company. Drexel Burnham made it possible to sell junk bonds, I mean, figuratively overnight, and allowed LBOs to compete on an equal basis with hostile takeovers of all designs. And by making them quicker and easier, to oversimplify, it allowed LBOs to really spread as they did, to really change the face of a corporate America in the late 80s.
Let's just pause for a moment to redefine what a leveraged buyout is and what a junk bond is.
Sure. Well, a leveraged buyout is a very simple financing technique that a lot of people have tried to make sound complicated. It happens when a group of executives who usually run the company for public shareholders decide to go to Wall Street, usually secretly, and borrow a few boatloads of money to buy back those shares from the shareholders. Now, the controversial part comes when they have to pay back all that money. To pay back the money, they use the firm's owned cash flow and its profits to free up more money to pay back the debt. They make cuts in every imaginable budget, from marketing to research to all the things that have typically made companies stronger. Now, the bet there is that they'll be able to pay back all the debt, make the company leaner and stronger, and ultimately employ more people. That's what happens in the best case scenario. Junk bond is simply, in its simplest guise, is a fairly risky IOU with a good dividend.
The RJR Reynolds takeover was the largest takeover in history. Give us a sense of the money involved here.
Well, it started at a paltry $17 billion. That was the initial bid by RJR President Ross Johnson and a group that included Shearson Lehman Hutt. And it ultimately got up to $25 billion, which is about twice the largest takeover we've ever seen, and a good four times larger than any previous leveraged buyouts. The fees paid to investment bankers, lawyers, commercial bankers, you name it, eventually topped $1 billion, including $75 million alone just to Kohlberg Kravis itself, then portions of $25 and $50 million parceled out to a number of investment banks. The money just goes on and on and on.
Brian Burrow is my guest, and he covered the takeover of RJR Nabisco for the Wall Street Journal and co-authored the new book Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of RJR Nabisco. The leveraged buyout of RJR Nabisco was initiated by F. Ross Johnson, who was the chief executive officer of the company. What's the logic behind the CEO raiding his own company?
Well, that was the question that everyone asked when Ross Johnson did it. RJR was a company that was not in trouble. Profits up, revenues up, dividends, employment all up. The logic, the easy answer is you make a heck of a lot of money. If Ross Johnson had been able to win this company, over the next 5 to 7 years, he could have made, by a conservative guess, $100 million. The question becomes, how do you justify that if you want to justify it as something other than just a grab for cash? Johnson rationalized that the LBO was a way to cure the company's lagging stock price, which had never really recovered from the stock market crash of 1987. In fact, my colleague John Hellyer and I found that the answer to why Ross Johnson launched this LBO really had to do with in his psyche and in his history. He was an executive who had risen through the ranks of a number of companies, had taken them over through smooth internal takeovers, but was the type of CEO who could never leave well alone. He fixated on little problems that other CEOs might have left, in this case a stock price that he considered low. By the end, he had gone through an array of Rube Goldberg-type schemes, including the notorious smokeless cigarette Premier, and he was left with a leveraged buyout. Now, if a leveraged buyout sounds like a fairly severe way to correct a low stock price, well, some of his own board members thought so as well. One of them, I recall, referred to it as taking a shotgun to someone to cure them of a hangnail.
Can you explain how a leveraged buyout would have boosted the stocks for his shareholders?
Well, it wouldn't have, in fact. It would have eliminated the stock by taking the stock out of the public's hands. The idea was that the public was never going to give a tobacco company its due in the stock price, so to heck with the public, we're just going to take the stock out of their hands and run it as a private company.
Did Johnson realize he was opening the door for a hostile takeover?
He was told that on a number of occasions, but his failure to recognize that was his fatal error. Time and again, his lawyer's investment banker said, you know, Ross, there's a chance, just a chance, that if we go out there and propose a leveraged buyout, someone can come in and boost it. And in fact, Johnson should have known that there were those out there that wanted to, chiefly among them Henry Kravis, the acknowledged king of the LBO industry, who'd made overtures to Johnson to do exactly that on a number of occasions. But Johnson and his advisors, in the end, felt that this company was simply too large, its mysteries too vast, for anyone to come in and challenge them. They thought they'd be able to walk away with this deal, that it would be, in Wall Street parlance, a slam dunk. And their failure to realize or to fathom the depths of the greed and the lust to make make points in the LBO industry on Wall Street that really killed them in the end.
Well, Kohlberg and Kravis created a hostile bid, and they won. What was in it for them? What did they stand to gain from taking over RJR Nabisco?
Well, ultimately, you know, through any LBO, certainly the largest, you're standing to look at hundreds of millions of dollars. But I dare say that wasn't what was on Henry Kravis's mind at the time of their initial bid. Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, the firm that Mr. Kravis is a partner in, all but created the leveraged buyout industry. It was created in 1976, and for years it had the LBO industry to itself until the early 80s, when people kind of caught on to what Kohlberg Kravis was doing. And a number of firms, Merrill Lynch and dozens of others, began crowding into the industry. And for the first time, deals that Mr. Kravis would have consummated himself on a friendly basis were certainly open to competitive bidding. Deals cost more. He lost deals for the first time. And so when an upstart firm named Shearson Lehman Hutton, which had never done an LBO, showed up with Ross Johnson saying that they had a right to do the largest LBO of all time, Mr. Kravis was incensed, and he attacked.
So his ego was threatened? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the long and the short of it, basically, was he'd had enough of these upstart competitors, and he couldn't believe the gall of someone like Shearson Lehman coming in. And you'd have to say that there was a large measure of ego involved there, yes.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Brian Burrow, co-author of the new book Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of RJR Nabisco. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Financial reporter Brian Burrow is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about the personalities involved in the takeover of RJR Nabisco. Now, Henry Kravis, you describe him as the king of Nouvelle Society.
Yeah, he was. Henry Kravis represented something of a departure for the LBO industry, which is largely dominated by relatively quiet gentlemen who don't make a lot of headlines. Mr. Kravis seemed to live for headlines. He and his fashion designer wife, Carolyn Rome, were for years and still are fixtures on the New York Society scene. He has a wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art named after him, and he's very socially active. He is exactly the opposite of the line of financiers who believed that the best profile was a low profile.
Now, Ross Johnson, who was the head of RJR Nabisco and the person who initiated the LBO, you describe him as a consummate non-company man.
Well, Ross was the consummate party man, as a matter of fact. He was a breezy, likable, golf-playing Canadian who put together a group of what we call merry men, and their MO was they like to play a lot of golf, go to a lot of parties, drink a lot of scotch, and shake up their companies constantly. Until Johnson initiated this LBO in the fall of 1988, he was acknowledged to be one of the top executives in the food and tobacco industries, and his reviews had been excellent. It was this deal, however, that really led to his demise and his depiction widely as something of a symbol of corporate greed nationally.
Kohlberg and Kravis won at the last minute. They won the bid to take over RJR Nabisco. Describe a little bit what happened at the last minute, because the two companies were neck and neck. I mean, The two groups. The two groups, thank you.
What had happened was, during the bidding for RJR, a number of other Wall Street firms literally crowded onto the field and piled on, and it became this huge rugby match. By the end, however, the only two that were left were the two that had started, the group led by Mr. Kravis and the group led by Mr. Johnson. During the final round of bidding, Mr. Kravis and his troops were able to, believe it or not, fool Mr. Johnson's troops to believing that Mr. Kravis had enough, that he was tired of the mudslinging and the adverse publicity, that he was walking away from this deal. And with that feeling in mind, Mr. Johnson's group didn't all but left its bid where it had been, bumped it all of a dollar. Mr. Kravis, who had been lying low for the last week before the biddings, put in a far higher bid, roared past them, and eventually won it on the strength of that bid.
Ross Johnson, the CEO of RJR Nabisco, who initiated the LBO, he lost, and he had to leave the company when the deal was finished. So he didn't make all the money he had expected to make through the leverage buyout of this company. Did he make any profit at all? Did he gain anything?
Shed no tears for Ross Johnson. He was able to walk off with a golden parachute with an estimated value of $53 million. Not a bad day at the park.
When you say the parachute, that's the kind of
parting. A severance agreement.
Okay. So $53
million. $53
million. Now, his final statement when leaving the company was that the process we commenced last October has benefited the company's stockholders and has proven the strength of our varied business. Did it benefit the company's stockholders?
Well, certainly, if you were a stockholder with a very short-term orientation, if you were in a Wall Street arbitrage or someone that was in there to make a killing, you made a killing. You made a lot of money. But keep in mind that RJR Nabisco stock was not a short-term market maker stock. This was a stock that was held by a lot of retirees, widely held by R.J. Reynolds employees who had kept it for decades and decades as something close to religion. And these were people that didn't want to unload their stock, but in the era of Wall Street in the 1980s, they really didn't have any choice.
Now, Kohlberg and Kravis, their company, got the LBO. They took over RJR Nabisco. What did they really win? What did they really get out of it?
Well, they got a lot of headlines and they got a lot of headaches. What they have now is the nation's 19th largest industrial company. They are attempting to pay down debt that is roughly six times what it had been. They're attempting to do this in an era where junk bonds are out of favor, and to make the deal profitable, they have to sell a lot of bonds left, and it's going to be very, very difficult, especially with the bankruptcy of Drexel Burnham. So what they bought themselves was a large degree of notoriety. This may prove to be the deal that killed the golden goose, and they bought themselves a lot of headaches over the long term.
How has the RJR Nabisco company changed since the takeover, and how do you think life for the employees has changed?
Well, in the near term, it is a smaller company, not a heck of a lot smaller. It will ultimately probably be about 20% to 25% smaller. I talked with some employees earlier this week who are working a lot harder, but so far they don't mind. The ones that have kept their jobs, therein lies the rub. I believe so far the best number is about 2,500 and counting employees have lost their job, and that, alas, is really the saddest part of all this. For while an awful lot of people can make money on Wall Street on these deals, an awful lot of employees lose their jobs.
Do you think that in the era of the LBO did permanent damage to American business and the American financial world?
Well, thankfully, I'm a storyteller and not a politician, and that's a plank that I haven't really walked out on aggressively. There are certainly two sides of that debate. I think it's very difficult to say that that LBOs have strengthened the corporate environment, but I'm not sure that they've done it lasting damage. There's a very persuasive argument that says that an LBO because it piles on so much debt onto a company's balance sheet, makes that company, those companies are now being run with an eye on the banks rather than an eye toward competition. The people who believe that argument will ask you, you know, how are we able to keep our eye on competition with the Japans and Germanys in the world when all we're focusing on is paying back debt? And I think there's some merit to that question.
I suppose you've seen in the New York Times and in Time Magazine this week, there were articles about around five different Wall Street-related books that were recently published, all focusing on the greed and the ego that ran amok during the 80s on Wall Street. Your book was included in both of those roundups. I find it very interesting that during the first half of the 80s, most of the best-selling business books and the business profiles were kind of glorifying financiers and CEOs. There was a lot of mythologizing of the grandness of these people. And then the 90s is beginning with wrap-ups about all these books about these people's downfalls and how they were driven by greed and ego.
It's a real stark comparison, isn't it? I remember during the early 80s, though, everyone, it was all new. It was hip. These people were the new superstars. And we hadn't really seen the fallout from some of the things that had happened there, and nobody really foresaw it. With the end of the decade, I think you're seeing a natural reassessment of what we did in the 1980s. That's certainly being fueled by some of the problems that a lot of these debt-heavy companies like Bloomingdale's have run into, that we're seeing that the banquet went on so long that that a lot of people are sick afterwards.
Has your style changed at all, or the type of stories that you focus on, you know, in related to what we're talking about?
Well, just because the conditions on Wall Street have changed, a lot of the reportage has changed as well. No one is doing stories on how deals are getting done. People are doing stories on how deals are being bankrupted, or how they're being saved, or you know, that's the type of thing that they're talking in the headlines.
I guess it's an exciting time to be a financial reporter.
Well, I dare say it was a very exciting time when all these deals were going on, but you could probably fault reporters for the same thing that you could fault the people that were doing the deals. Everyone was so caught up in the chase, in the battle, that no one really thought about what were we doing here. A lot of people were not asking the questions until too late of what all this meant. And I think now we are learning a hard lesson of what at least some of the deals have come to mean.
Well, Brian Burrow, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Burrow is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and co-author with John Hillier of the new book Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of R.J.R. Nabisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, British novelist Margaret Drabble. In the early 60s, she was one of the first writers to create contemporary female characters who were grappling with professional careers and the demands of home and family. Her books include The Needle's Eye, The Ice Age, and A Natural Curiosity. She also edited the Oxford Companion to English Literature. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For She's Gotta Have It, School Days, Do the Right Thing, for all of Spike Lee's movies, Ernest Dickerson has been the man behind the camera. Dickerson's title is director of photography, but he often ends up directing when Spike Lee is acting. Coming up, Ernest Dickerson tells us about his ongoing collaboration with Spike Lee. Also, what do filmmaker John Sayles, school principal Deborah Meyer, and anthropologist David Stewart have in common? They've all received what's commonly called the Genius Award, the annual MacArthur Fellowship. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new collection of interviews with 40 MacArthur recipients. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The African National Congress has announced it is willing to meet with South African President F.W. de Klerk about opening talks on ending a long guerrilla war against apartheid. If the meeting takes place, it would be the first between exile leaders of the guerrilla movement and a South African head of state. NPR's John Madison says that ANC leaders want the talks to have more than one dimension.
The most important decision was that they will come in and discuss with de Klerk the remaining obstacles to formal negotiations, that is especially what they call the armed struggle. The government has asked them to abandon the armed struggle, and they said today they're not going to do that unilaterally. It has to be part of an agreement, and they want to discuss with the government its violence, in other words, the violence of the South African police in the black townships at the moment.
NPR's John Madison in Johannesburg. The foreign minister of Kenya, Robert Uko, has been found dead on his farm. Although details of his death are not known, a government statement said that foul play is suspected. Lindsay Hilson of the BBC filed this report.
Dr. Uko was last seen on Tuesday. It appears that he left his farm in the early hours of the morning, but his family don't seem to know where he was going, and it's unclear whether he went on foot or by car. After the family issued a statement saying he was missing, President Daniel Arap Moi instructed the country's top security personnel to trace him.
Lindsay Hilson of the BBC. Western defense experts, winding up 2 days of talks in Paris, have decided to ease restrictions on sales of certain types of equipment to Eastern Europe. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
U.S. officials said that COCOM, the trade watchdog group of the Western Alliance, had decided to give special treatment to East European countries that are moving towards democracy and are capable of policing exports of high technology themselves. The proposal was backed by the U.S., which wants to retain restrictions on exports to Moscow. Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia have volunteered to police their own exports. COCOM plans to send a delegation to those countries in the near future to set up the control mechanisms. COCOM also decided to speed up the processing of export applications for all countries worldwide, including the Soviet Union. Washington wanted Moscow excluded from that, but under pressure from Western Europe, it was forced to back down. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
President Bush and Mrs. Bush are spending the long President's Day weekend at their home in Maine. The president returned last night from a 6-hour drug summit meeting in Colombia and met this morning with his cabinet. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 14 points to close at 2,635.59 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Last year's most controversial film was Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, but most people were in agreement that the film was beautifully shot by Ernest Dickerson. Dickerson was also the cinematographer on Spike Lee's two other features, She's Gotta Have It and School Days. His other credits include John Sayles' Brother from Another Planet, Crush Groove, the Eddie Murphy concert film Raw, and Peter Wong's new film Laser Man. I spoke with Dickerson about his collaborations with Spike Lee. He told me how they first met.
Well, we met in film school, our first year at New York University Graduate School of Film and Television. And although we really didn't work together in the first year because we were in two separate classes, you know, we talked and saw a lot of movies together and pretty much planned on working together as soon as we could, which was in second year of graduate school. Spike was a directing and a writing major, and I was a cinematography major. And we've worked together ever since.
Together with Spike Lee, you've made films about black people, with black actors, with largely black crews. Is it important to you to do that?
Well, yeah. Actually, the crews have been pretty much 50-50. Mm-hmm. They've been pretty integrated. Yeah, it is important for us, especially in the crews, because most of the time there's a lot of qualified black technicians who are mostly shut out when it comes to the crewing up process. For a lot of different reasons, we've found that, you know, people have come to town looking for, you know, black people to put on their crew, and for one reason or another, producers told them they couldn't find anybody, even though the town is full of them.
Were you ever worried about being shut out yourself?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's happened. I've gotten some pretty lame excuses for not hiring me. I've been told my work is too pretty. I was even turned down for a job one time because the producer wasn't sure if I could photograph a tree. That's what he told me. The film was taking place in the country. And most of what he had seen of my work was in, you know, in the urban environment. And he wasn't too sure if I could photograph a tree. Those were his words.
How long ago was this?
This was about 3-4 years ago. I still get shut out for various reasons. Sometimes the director wants me, and sometimes the producer wants somebody else, and they'll tell the producer that I'm unavailable, they'll tell the director I'm unavailable, even though I am. So I've found that out several times, much to my dismay.
Mm-hmm. The movies that you've made with Spike Lee have also starred Spike Lee. What's the difference for you as the director of photography when Spike Lee is in the shot and when he's not in the shot?
Well, when he's in front of the camera, he needs an objective eye to kind of co-direct him through his performances and keep an eye on what he's not able to see because he's in front of the camera, and that's the job that I have. It puts a little bit more responsibility on me because I usually have to, you know, concentrate on performance as well. Spike does put a lot on me usually in terms of designing the look of the films and also designing entire sequences shot by shot. But when he's in front of the camera, then in a way I almost have to step into the director's chair for a few minutes.
Well, that must be really good for you. I mean, it's another challenge to take on.
Yeah, well, I like it. I mean, it's prevented me from just looking at any of his films as just a job. I mean, I get more involved than I imagine the average cinematographer might.
The first time you worked with him on camera, were you surprised at the amount of presence that he had, film presence?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because it's the kind of thing you really don't see at first. When he first did that, it was on She's Gotta Have It. And he did it mainly because he couldn't afford anybody else. And we always thought of it as kind of a joke because Spike was the last person we thought we'd want to get in front of the camera. And then finally, after it was all over and we started seeing the film cut together, that's when we started seeing what was going on there. And he definitely stole the show. And a lot of people were surprised to know, find out that he was Spike Lee. Several times I saw it with an audience, and they knew that Spike Lee was in it, and they knew that Spike Lee directed it. And at the end, he shows all the actors, and they go through their, you know, they announce their names, their own names. And at the end, he says, Spike Lee, and everybody in the audience says, that's Spike Lee? It was kind of funny.
Did they think he'd be one of the taller, more conventionally good-looking guys in the film?
Yeah, I guess that most of them probably thought he was Tommy Hicks.
Mm-hmm. Your skills have grown as the budgets of your films have grown. Do the Right Thing was, I think, the first movie that you and Spike Lee did together that had a union crew. How does having a union crew affect your job and what you could depend on others to do and what you have to do yourself?
Well, actually, we did have a union crew on School Days, even though it was shot non-union in a right-to-work state, but most of the people were members of the NABUT local down there.
I see.
It's not so much the union crew, because there are a lot of good non-union crews in town. It was the money to give us more time to do things the way we really wanted to do them. If you don't have enough time to really perfect a shot or a sequence, a lot of times you're rushing and you get whatever you can in the time that you have. On Do the Right Thing, we had 10 weeks of shooting, which was very comfortable. And it enabled me to do a lot of things. I had more control over the image. If the light wasn't exactly right, we had time to wait for it, which was something I had always considered a luxury. Sometimes if the light wasn't right, I had time to build the light. I mean, there were several days where we had rainy days, and I had to make it look like sun. And doing something like that takes time, and we had the time to do that with. That's the thing that more money gives you.
How do you make a rainy day look like sun?
Well, I used a combination of brute arcs, which I still think is the closest approximation of sunlight. It's a big light. It's made by an arc that's passed between an electrical arc, a spark that's actually passed between two carbon rods, and it's the texture of the light is the closest to sunlight I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
There's one scene in the beginning of the movie where some folks are sitting on the stoop and they first meet Radio Raheem. What I did was to cover over the entire stoop area with big reflectors. And I bounced blue light into the white of the reflectors to simulate like blue light coming from a blue sky. And then with the arcs coming, simulating hard sunlight and just careful balancing it. I look at it today and I think it's one of the things I'm proudest about the film is that I was able to really achieve sunlight. It looks like sunlight, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're telling us that you work closely with Spike Lee in designing the look of a film. Can you talk a little bit about designing the look of Do the Right Thing?
Yeah. Well, long before Spike had the story nailed down, he told me he wanted to do something that took place on the hottest day of the year. He wanted to highlight the fact that he had read that the murder rate rises on very hot days. That on hot days, the tempers are short, nerves are frayed, people are like very nervous, the heat just like aggravates the smallest thing. And he wanted to convey that visually. And he talked to me about ways of doing it. What I figured was that we had to limit the color scale, stay away from cool colors, really hone in more on the yellows and reds, the warm part of the spectrum, and also play with various degrees of overexposure to get the feeling of glare,
mm-hmm.
Especially at midday. Also, since the script took place in one day, I also had to show how the light changes in the course of the day. The light goes from very low in the sky in the morning, usually a warmer light, to very glary, hard, hot light at midday. And then back into like a warmer, softer, redder light at the end of the day.
Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson is my guest, and we're talking about his work with filmmaker Spike Lee. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson is my guest, and we're talking about his work on Spike Lee's film, Do the Right Thing. I want to ask you a question about the most controversial scene in the movie, and this is the scene where Danny Aiello breaks Radio Raheem's boombox, and the fight that they're having becomes, erupts into a riot. From everything I've read about the making of the film, Danny Aiello didn't like the way that scene was initially written and didn't much like the way his role was written, and he expanded on it. He put in a lot more biography about the character and everything. During the period when he and Spike Lee were discussing how this character should be and how that scene should be played out, where were you? Did you participate in that discussion, or did you just kind of
keep away until that's resolved between director and actor.
Yeah, that's a very personal conversation between director and actor. Spike and Danny worked that out between themselves in rehearsals and all their conferences, talking about who the character is and where he goes, how he develops. I'm not usually privy to that. But a lot of times I see it happening on the set, and sometimes, you know, an actor will ask me a second opinion about what I'm seeing.
You just wrapped a film. The film's initial title was Love Supreme. I don't really know what it's being called now.
It's called The Mo Better Blues.
And it stars, I believe, Denzel Washington as a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just fill us in a little bit more on what the basic premise of the movie is?
Basic premise is, I think it's a dilemma that a lot of artists go through. When your devotion to your art gets in the way of your personal life, and vice versa. He's a trumpeter. He's devoted to his music. He makes no bones about telling the two ladies in his life that his music comes first. And naturally, they have problems with that.
Now, how did you prepare to shoot this movie?
One of the things that we did, spent a lot of time with the art director, as usual. I think it's very important to have a good rapport with a production designer, because he's the guy or the girl that's going to put the put those things out there that you're going to photograph. I always work with him to discuss the colors that are being used in the sets. I believe in controlling color and controlling the palette of the film. You discuss lighting in locations and things like that. An example is there's a major set that was built is called the Club Underdog. And one of the things I worked out with him was letting the club light itself as much as possible, so that when we went in, most of the work was already, or most of the lighting was already integrated into the design of the club. And, you know, it's things like this that help you get the look of a film. You really have to work closely with a production designer and the costume designer.
Since this film is about a jazz musician, did you go back and watch any classic jazz films?
No, no classic jazz films. We looked at a lot of jazz photography, especially of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. We went through a lot of books. There was a book that I've had for years. It's a book called Jazz Street by a photographer named Dennis Stock. And it's all black and white. Photographs of jazz musicians backstage, at work, even portraits, documentary-type stuff in clubs. I mean, really beautiful photography. And I looked at that quite a bit to give me an inspiration for the feeling of the club and different musical numbers.
So what point are you right now in making this new film?
Mo Better Blues is currently in the editing stages.
Are you in on that?
No. Well, I come in at the end after it's all cut together, and I do what's called the final color grading, which is I supervise the master of what is going to be the template for the release prints. And that's making sure that all the colors, all the brightnesses or the darknesses, the shadings that I went for in the lighting make it to the final print.
Is it typical for a cinematographer to have that control at the end of the process?
Yeah, it should be. Most of the time, I am able to do that. I have it written into my contract. That's just to ensure that my work makes it to the screen the way it should be. There have been a couple of times when I've been shut out, or the producers just didn't schedule it. A lot of times producers don't want to bring a cinematographer in for reasons of their own. I mean, sometimes they think it's going to cost them more money. A lot of cinematographers would do it for free just to make sure that their work makes it to the screen intact.
Mm-hmm. When you were back in school and you were learning about film lighting, were a lot of the lighting techniques that you were taught really designed to light white skin, white faces?
Yeah. The whole exposure system is based around Caucasian tone. But before I went to film school, I studied still photography. I minored in color photographic illustration at Howard University. And most of the models that I photographed were black, so even then, I had started working out my own methods, my own exposure methods for black folks.
How different is it?
I don't feel it's that different, probably because it's, I think it's become second nature to me now. It's basically placing the values, the skin, the tonal values, where I want them. It's also a combination of makeup also, because one of the things you don't want to do is dull black skin too much, especially dark skin, because you cut down its reflectivity if you do that. So actually a light moisturizer in the skin is usually required, and I usually talk that over with the makeup person.
Mm-hmm. Any other different considerations?
It depends upon the situation. It depends upon if the black actor is in the same scene with a white actor. Sometimes that can be problematical, because if you have to put a little bit more light on the black actor, then it'll burn out the white actor. So sometimes it comes into using nets to just shade and try and achieve a balance between the two.
Earlier in our conversation, you said that you thought that there was a time when you were shut out, that you weren't given offers that you thought you perhaps would have been given had you not been black. Do you still feel that way? I mean, your films are really getting very well known and are very successful. Do you still feel that you're being shut out from certain films?
Well, I'm not turning down work yet.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, I interview for projects that I think I'm ideal for. And usually I'm given an indication that they'd really like to use my services, but a lot of the times I'm not used. So I get that. I mean, I've gotten 2 turned downs in the past 2 weeks, but then I get calls from people that you know, insist that I shoot their production. So it goes both ways.
Well, I wish you the best with your new films, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson. His new films include Peter Wong's Laser Man and Spike Lee's upcoming film, Mo Better Blues. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi there, Terry. We're going to have a preview of the Nicaraguan elections, which are coming up very soon, and we're going to take a closer look at some of the plans that are being made for Germany. NATO has announced a plan today for the military reconstruction of Germany. And we'll be talking to William Shirer, the historian who has written so much about Germany, about the borders Germany once had. As you know, Terry, the Germans refer to this as unification, not reunification, because Germany used to be much bigger.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every year, an award called the MacArthur Fellowship is granted to people who've demonstrated exceptional creativity in their chosen fields. There's a new book that explores the creative process through interviews with MacArthur Fellows. It's called Uncommon Genius, How Great Ideas Are Born, and its author is Denise Shakurjan. Critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
There used to be an old TV show called The Millionaire. At the beginning of every episode, the rich recluse, John Beresford Tipton, would instruct his secretary, Michael Anthony, to deliver $1 million to some stranger who would inevitably be made miserable by the money. Well, the MacArthur Prize, or Genius Award as it's often called, works in much the same way as Mr. Tipton's checks, except the selection process for the MacArthurs is even more mysterious. The only qualification for the MacArthur Prize, besides genius, is that candidates must be American citizens or residents. Winners receive anywhere from $30,000 to $70,000 a year for 5 years, and a few have even won it for life. No strings attached. The bad news is that you can't apply for a MacArthur. You have to be secretly nominated by one of the Foundation's anonymous talent scouts. The good news is that at this very minute, many of us could be in the running for the prize because no one, except for Ronald Reagan, knows how to define genius. Reagan told Bill Moyers in a 1980 interview that the guy who invented those rubber insulators for beer cans was, without a doubt, the embodiment of American genius. But the MacArthur Committee seems less certain about its criteria. After all, genius fads are so erratic. Sinclair Lewis won the Nobel Prize in the 20s. Now his reputation's as dead as the Model T. Since 1981, MacArthurs have been awarded to some poets and lawyers, a carpenter, a paleontologist, a whale song chronicler, and a clown. In her new book, Uncommon Genius, Denise Shakurjian doesn't bother to analyze the category of genius. She simply assumes that the 40 MacArthur winners she interviews are smart people who can tell us something about creativity and how to nurture it. John Sayles, for instance, stresses the importance of concentration and recalls writing a 120-page film script in 3 days. Sculptor Robert Irwin describes how he isolated himself in his studio for 2 years and just painted lines to learn the essentials of his craft. Deborah Meyer, a Harlem school principal, emphasizes the importance of risk-taking. Then there's David Stewart, who decodes Mayan hieroglyphics. At 18, he's the youngest MacArthur Fellow, but like many of the others, he describes a long dance with uncertainty that usually precedes his creative breakthroughs. These MacArthur winners seem comfortable with ambiguity. The rest of us, however, tend to anxiously grab for quick answers and suffer from what environmentalist Les Brown calls a hardening of the categories. Unfortunately, Shakurjian often digresses from her MacArthur Fellow's stories to reflect on her own creativity in writing the book. It's like she's trying to nominate herself for a genius award. But if you can ignore this indulgence, Uncommon Genius offers an important insight. These MacArthur winners work like dogs, and so demolish the romantic idea that creative people are passively inspired. The book also dispels the Puritan myth that fueled the plots of The Millionaire, namely, that found money always brings misery. None of these MacArthur winners sound too unhappy, and none have returned the checks. That's the American genius for common sense.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Uncommon Genius by Denise Shakurjian. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Our production assistants are Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sherrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with British novelist Margaret Drabble. We also meet John Malpied and Kevin Williams of the LAPD. That's the Los Angeles Poverty Department. It's a theater group that draws its members from the homeless. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. That's Fresh Air's film critic Stephen Schiff, and I think he just saved you a lot of money. Yeah. Speaking of money, our number is 923-1234, and you can continue to call as we join our next program. But before we do, I just want to say thank you to everybody who's called throughout the week to pledge during Fresh Air. It's meant a lot to us. We appreciate your